Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much. Crystal and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care Workshop, Update on Mantle Cell Lymphoma. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And really, we also have a number of other organizations, cancer organizations as well. And because of that collaboration and your interest in this program, we have over 539 participants on the call today. So this is a very large call. And we have people from all of the United States, from all different areas of the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Cyprus, India, Ireland, Israel, Switzerland, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So really, you are from all over the world. It's a bit of a global call. And today's program is supported through an unrestricted educational grant to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Celgene Corporation. And I really want to, it's really a pleasure working with the Lymphoma Research Foundation. They're a wonderful resource for all of you on this program, and you'll be hearing more about the Lymphoma Research Foundation if you don't know more about them shortly from Max Mulcahy, who's really been the architect of today's program. Now, I want to begin by introducing our first speaker for today, and our first speaker is Dr. Bharat Kahl. Dr. Kahl is Professor of Medicine, Division of Oncology, Department of Medicine, Washington University School of Medicine, Director of Lymphoma Program, Seidman Cancer Center. And Dr. Kahl is going to address an overview of mantle cell lymphoma, treatment options for newly diagnosed, emerging treatment options, and communicating with the healthcare team. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Kahl.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here today and have a chance to speak to everyone again about mantle cell lymphoma. So we always get a wide range of knowledge in our audience, but I'm going to try to just start out by covering a few basics about mantle cell lymphoma to make sure everybody understands the disease a little bit, and then I'll talk a little bit about frontline treatment options. So mantle cell lymphoma is a form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It is derived from a cell called a lymphocyte, which is a cell of the immune system, actually a B lymphocyte, so this is also considered a B cell lymphoma. And mantle cell lymphoma is not the most common type of lymphoma. It only makes up about 6% of new lymphoma diagnoses. And that does make it a little bit challenging to study, to make progress when diseases are rare. It's always a little tougher to figure out better ways to treat it, although I'm proud to say that there has been really tremendous improvement in treatments and outcomes for mantle cell lymphoma during my career, and it's been very gratifying to see that. Mantle cell lymphoma has a unique biology. It's really defined by what's called a chromosomal translocation. What that means is little pieces of the DNA break apart and really flip-flop with one another. And the hallmark translocation in mantle cell lymphoma is called the 11-14 translocation. That just refers to the chromosomes that are involved. And the result of this translocation is overexpression of a protein called cyclin D1. And when these cancer cells, these mantle cells, overproduce cyclin D1, the cells lose their normal ability to divide, and they divide abnormally and irregularly. And this is really the hallmark of mantle cell lymphoma. By the time patients come to diagnosis, there are lots of other mutations that have developed in the DNA, so it's more than just an 11-14 translocation in this cyclin D1 overexpression. It ends up being more complicated than that, but that is thought to be an early and initiating event for the development of mantle cell lymphoma. Mantle cell has some very unique clinical features. It's much more common in men, and we actually don't understand the reasons for that yet. The average age for mantle cell lymphoma is 65 years old at diagnosis, but we really see a wide range of ages. We see people in their 30s and 40s and people in their 80s and 90s diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma. Mantle cell lymphoma is almost always stage 4 disease at diagnosis, and it's important that people understand that the stage 4 terminology is not as important in lymphomas as it is in other cancers. Just know that in mantle cell lymphoma, to be stage 4 is normal. That's the way almost everybody comes to us with their new disease, and we can treat it very effectively, whether it's stage 1, 2, 3, or 4. But honestly, we hardly ever see patients with stage 1 or 2 mantle cell lymphoma. Almost never happens. It's very common to have the blood involved, the bone marrow involved, and involvement of the GI tract, which is why it is considered stage 4 at diagnosis. About a quarter to a half of patients will have symptoms where they might feel poorly. Other patients just come to attention because they noticed a simple lump, which is an enlarged lymph node, or maybe their disease was just picked up on routine blood work, and that's what led to the diagnosis. There are a proportion of patients who actually have what's called an indolent version of the disease, maybe 15, 20, 25% of patients, where the disease grows more slowly. And these patients are actually candidates to be just observed initially. In other words, they don't have to start immediately on treatment. I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit more in the question and answer, and it can be a little bit tricky trying to identify who are the appropriate patients for this strategy of simple observation, but it is appropriate for selected patients. However, the majority of patients who are diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma will need to start therapy relatively soon. Because of the disease is considered to be widespread or systemic, if it's in the blood, it's in the bone marrow, it's everywhere. Patients need systemic therapy. You need a treatment that gets into the body and works everywhere. So we don't use radiation therapy very often in mantle cell lymphoma, just rarely. Usually it involves getting chemotherapy or maybe some new so-called targeted agents. There are some basic things we try to learn about each patient at diagnosis. There's something called the MIPI score, M-I-P-I, MIPI. And we can calculate the score in a newly diagnosed patient, and it allows us to make some estimates about that particular patient's version of the disease. Do they have a more aggressive version? Do they have a less aggressive version? And there's actually a newer version of this MIPI score that also incorporates a special test called a Ki-67 stain, which is a simple test that can be done on the diagnostic specimen, on the biopsy, and that gives us a sense of the proliferation, or in other words, how fast are the mantle cells growing in that particular patient. And so when you factor in the 4 clinical factors in the MIPI score along with the Ki-67, we can generate a score. And so if people are interested in discussing that with their physician, that's something that we can derive. Score will influence the treatment recommendation. Sometimes it doesn't, frankly. It just depends on the individual situation. The diagnosis of mantle cell lymphoma is not particularly difficult to make nowadays. It used to be more difficult, but with specialized testing now, with an adequate biopsy, the pathologist can stain the tissue for the cyclin D1 protein, which is a very good marker for mantle cell lymphoma, or we can do something called a FISH test, which can look for this 11-14 translocation that I mentioned earlier. So with specialized testing, it's actually not terribly difficult to correctly diagnose mantle cell lymphoma nowadays. When we have a patient who's newly diagnosed, we need to complete a staging evaluation, and that's really just figuring out where the disease is and how much of it there is. Often that involves getting some kind of imaging. More often than not, it's a PET scan. Occasionally it might be a CAT scan, but nowadays usually a PET scan. Most patients will end up getting a bone marrow test to see if the bone marrow is involved. They may or may not have endoscopies. That's looking in the stomach and the colon. Involvement of the central nervous system is actually pretty uncommon in mantle cells, so usually patients do not require lumbar punctures. So once you have the diagnostic issues sorted out, the MIPI score, the staging all done, then you can sit down with a patient and really start talking about what might be the most appropriate management strategy as initial treatment. And as I mentioned, you will occasionally have a patient whose disease was found incidentally. They feel fine. They feel perfect, actually. They wouldn't have known they even had the disease unless someone had stumbled upon it. And maybe after we do all the staging, we determine that they have a very low tumor burden, and that just means there's not much of it in their body. And those are the kind of patients who can start out on the so-called watch and wait strategy or observation strategy. And if we do that with a patient, we usually watch them very closely initially just to make sure that the disease is behaving itself and not growing too rapidly. Those patients can start out on observation, and then treatment doesn't have to be initiated until they develop symptoms or the disease starts to reach a high tumor burden stage, which is detected by imaging. More typically, the patients have higher tumor burden or they have symptoms, and we're talking about treatment strategies. And in general, around the world, the approach for initial treatment of mantle cell lymphoma is to look at a patient's age and their fitness and how intense of a treatment strategy they can really tolerate. And if patients are young and healthy, younger and healthier, I should say, they might be offered what I would call an intensive treatment strategy, which could involve relatively high doses of chemotherapy. It could involve something called an autologous stem cell transplant as part of the treatment program. That's the most common strategy used around the world for younger mantle cell patients. And that's a tougher strategy. It's a more difficult treatment course for the patients, at least for the period of time while they're on that treatment. And it could take 4 to 6 months to get through the initial treatment, and then the stem cell transplant adds a few more months of feeling not the greatest. But the advantage to that approach is that the remissions tend to be deep and durable. And so once you get through that kind of difficult 6 to 12 month period of treatment, patients can enjoy extremely long remissions that last for years and years and years. And so within a few months of finishing the treatment, we find most people are feeling back to their baseline, and it's very gratifying to see them 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years later still in their first remission, and that rough year seemed worth it at that time. For older patients who really aren't candidates for such an intensive strategy, we usually try to find less intensive approaches. There are a variety of reasonable approaches for patients in that category. Treatment strategies using agents like bendamustine and rituximab work very well in mantle cell lymphoma. Some places around the world use rituximab and CHOP chemotherapy for mantle cell lymphoma. Often, patients will receive a maintenance strategy once they've been placed in remission, and usually that's in the form of rituximab maintenance therapy, and that can go on for 2 or 3 years or sometimes even indefinitely depending upon the practice pattern of that particular physician. The remissions with the non-intensive treatment strategies tend not to be quite as durable as it is with the intensive treatment strategies, although they still can be durable, and those less intensive treatment strategies are certainly easier to get through that treatment. There are some newer strategies that have been pursued as initial treatment. For example, there's a drug called lenalidomide, which is an oral agent that works quite well in mantle cell lymphoma, and that's been combined with rituximab as initial therapy and looked quite promising in an early study. And that strategy could be offered to a newly diagnosed patient. And I think Dr. Gopal will talk about some of the newer agents that have been developed in the last few years that are showing promise in mantle cell lymphoma. For example, drugs like the BTK inhibitors, Bruton tyrosine kinase. And these drugs are approved for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma, but there are very important studies going on around the world right now looking at combining these targeted agents like the BTK inhibitors with standard chemotherapy And it will be really interesting to see if this ends up being a better strategy than what we've done historically. And we just don't quite have the answers to those studies yet, but those answers are not too far away. I'll just kind of conclude my portion by talking about the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. You know, communication, it's like any other relationship. It requires ability to be candid and frank with one another. It requires good listening skills. And, you know, I think most healthcare providers appreciate it when their patients ask them pertinent questions, hard questions, good questions. So don't be shy. Don't be afraid about really challenging your physician and your healthcare team about explaining why they're doing what they're doing, why they're recommending that, what your other options are. You should never be afraid to really ask why this is being done and what are my other options. And most of us enjoy having these kinds of conversations with patients because we want our patients to be informed and educated and part of the decision-making process. With that, I think I'll stop and turn it back to Carolyn, and I look forward to the question and answer portion.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Call. That was very, very informative, and actually your comments about the communicating with the healthcare team is so important that people do ask those questions, and so thank you very much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Ajay Gopal. Dr. Gopal is Professor of Medicine, Division of Medical Oncology, University of Washington, Member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Clinical Research Director and Associate Medical Director, Hematology and Hematologic Malignancies, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Gopal is going to be addressing treatment options for relapsed refractory disease, the role of clinical trials, key questions to ask your healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Gopal.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for the opportunity to speak today. So really many of the things that I'm going to talk about are similar to the strategies that one thinks about in terms of the initial therapy. So we have made great strides as a field in terms of improving ability to get the first remission and to extend the first remission with strategies like Dr. Call mentioned, such as stem cell transplantation or adding rituximab maintenance. But unfortunately, many people, and eventually this mantle cell lymphoma will come back. And then the question is, what's the next step? And this really gets back again to discussing with your provider, your physician, about what your goals are. And I'm going to probably move a little bit to that part first before I talk about specific therapies. And when I see someone that has a relapse of their mantle cell lymphoma, we have a discussion about how long has it been since the initial therapy. Did they have a very long remission after a fairly gentle therapy, or did this come back quickly after a fairly intensive therapy? And that gives me a bit of a feel about how aggressively the mantle cell lymphoma is behaving and how aggressive we might need to be if that's so desired by the patient in terms of treating it. And so I do talk about what the overall goals are, and is this something that we are going to try to use one therapy after another to try to keep it in control as long as possible, or are we going to try to get the mantle cell lymphoma back into remission, particularly for my younger and fitter patients, and do something that might give a long remission and with a possibility of eradicating the lymphoma, such as an allogeneic transplant. So I have that discussion, particularly with my younger and fitter patients who want to be very aggressive, to just know whether that's something they would like to pursue with all the risks and quality of life issues that can come with allogeneic transplantation. So often that's the first decision about, do I treat or do I not treat, and do we go into an aggressive strategy where we're moving to transplant, or do we do these sequential therapies and try to control the disease as long as we can. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the options that we have, and this is where there's been a huge explosion of approved options. And as Dr. Call mentioned, there's a class of drugs called the BTK inhibitors, Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And I often explain to my patients that in these cancerous B cells, there's kind of a switch that's always turned on. These switches only supposed to be turned on when these B cells are normally fighting infections, but this is kind of always turned on. And drugs like ibrutinib and more recently acalabrutinib are really there to go and try to turn that switch back off again that tells the cells to stop growing and dividing. So ibrutinib was approved for treatment of mantle cell lymphoma. It's a pill therapy, and it's actually very well tolerated, certainly compared to some of the more aggressive therapies that we have. And this is an option that we discuss and can offer to patients. There is a more recent version, a second generation, they call it a BTK inhibitor, which was just very recently approved within the last several weeks, called acalabrutinib, which is similar to ibrutinib and is also a pill therapy. There are other options. Lenalidomide was mentioned. This drug is approved for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. It's also a pill and has a very modest side effect profile, so it's really pretty easy to take, like ibrutinib and acalabrutinib. There's another agent that's been approved some time ago for mantle cell lymphoma called bortezomib, and it's being used sometimes as part of frontline therapy as well. But this is a injection that you can get under the skin and also really is pretty easy compared to other chemotherapies. So in terms of approved new type agents for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma, which I just went through four of them, which, as was mentioned, you know, certainly when I've, as long as I've been doing lymphoma care and research for about 20 years, these were not even thought of at that time. Bendamustine can also be used if it wasn't, particularly if it wasn't used before. It can also be effective for treatment of relapsed disease. So these are some of the things that may be discussed with your treating physician as something that could be used right off the shelf. But I do want to mention a little bit about clinical trials. And obviously all the therapies that I just mentioned were developed by folks participating in clinical trials. And I think particularly for a disease like mantle cell lymphoma, which is very difficult to eradicate permanently, clinical trials offer new options for patients and allow patients to have access to novel agents, which may be more effective or may be safer than what we have available. Certainly, a clinical trial is a question. It is not an answer. It answers the question, and I emphasize that to my patients that if we knew if this drug was better, it would not be in a clinical trial. It would be approved. So I think that's always important to keep in mind that clinical trials are there to answer a question, but they do potentially offer therapies that one could not otherwise have access to. And it also offers quite a bit of hope, particularly for individuals who are in tough situations where the standard therapies are no longer effective. So I think this does get to the question part about when you speak with your healthcare provider. One question that I would encourage to ask is, are there any clinical trials that are appropriate for me? The trials may not be appropriate, and you can speak with your physician regarding which ones are right for you, but it's always something worth bringing up. So as we talk a little bit about questions to ask, this also interfaces with quality of life issues, and I think this gets back to what I mentioned before when I talk with patients about their overall philosophy and strategy. For example, allogeneic transplant is potentially curative. However, it also has a lot of upfront risk, and it can impact one's quality of life for the long term. So these are factors that one has to consider. Even when you consider your initial therapy for mantle cell lymphoma, as Dr. Call referenced, high-dose therapy and autologous stem cell transplant is pretty tough stuff. It's tough stuff of a relatively short duration, but some people may opt for a gentler therapy that goes over a longer period of time. And we do not yet know whether transplant or some of the new agents, which one is better. Those studies are ongoing, and we hopefully will see those results in the next couple of years. So quality of life is an important consideration. The newer therapies that we have, particularly those for relapse disease, tend to have less side effects than the traditional chemotherapy approaches. But it's important to maintain dialogue with your provider about treatment options. I'll just talk a little bit about one question that comes up quite a bit, and maybe this will address some questions that people may be asking, is about this technology called chimeric antigen receptor modified T cells. And we all get lots of questions about this, and this is a very exciting strategy where we can take one's own T cells, these cancer-fighting T cells, and engineer them to go back and attack the lymphoma. We can then put them back in your body, and they can go and attack the lymphoma, the mantle cell lymphoma. There has been one that has been approved for a more common type of lymphoma called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and studies are ongoing looking at this in terms of mantle cell lymphoma. And for patients who want to be aggressive, this is a therapy that it is kind of like getting a transplant. So it has some risk associated with it, and it has a lot of time commitment and potential side effects. But for folks who want to be aggressive about the treatment of their mantle cell lymphoma, and if it's relapsed, I will refer them to a clinical trial regarding these CAR T cells, as we call them. So we don't actually have a lot of data yet in this setting, and there's a large study that's ongoing in mantle cell lymphoma that has not read out yet, but certainly for those who are interested in this approach, I would encourage participation in clinical trials. So I think with that, I might turn things back over to Dr. Messner, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Kapal. That was excellent, very, very comprehensive, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. Max Mulcahy. Ms. Mulcahy is Senior Director, Patient and Professional Education, Lymphoma Research Foundation, and Mr. Mulcahy really has been instrumental in making today's program possible, and so I want to turn this program over to Mr. Mulcahy, who is going to address actually the Lymphoma Research Foundation's few programs, conferences, and services, and so I turn this over to my colleague, Mr. Mulcahy.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and to Cancer Care for our continued partnership. And I would also like to thank our esteemed faculty today, Dr. Brad Call and Dr. Ajay Gopal. Thank you both for sharing your time and expertise today and for everything you do for the Lymphoma Research Foundation and people affected by mantle cell lymphoma. And I would also like to acknowledge our corporate supporter, Celgene Corporation, for supporting today's call. And last but not least, I would like to thank each of you for dialing in and joining us today. As some of you may know, the Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted to funding innovative research and serving the lymphoma and CLL community. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease, and we achieve this mission by providing comprehensive education programs, outreach initiatives, and patient services. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying potentially life-saving therapies to treat mantle cell lymphoma through an aggressively funded research program that's guided by LRF scientific leadership, who are among the world's leading experts in lymphoma. LRF invests millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and CLL and has played a key role in accelerating the understanding and treatment of mantle cell lymphoma. To date, LRF has funded nearly $60 million in lymphoma-specific research. The foundation also remains committed to providing comprehensive disease-specific resources, programs, and services to those who have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis, And some of these resources include our lymphoma helpline, where our professionally trained staff can assist you in your search for MCL disease and treatment information, as well as resources and other support services. We also offer a clinical trials information service, which provides information about clinical trials. And then we do the legwork to help you identify an appropriate trial for your diagnosis that's in your geographic area. And we also offer our Lymphoma Support Network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that pairs lymphoma patients or caregivers with others who are having a similar lymphoma experience. Disease specificity is the hallmark of the foundation, and we offer a variety of mantle cell lymphoma-specific resources, which include our comprehensive disease guides that are specifically to non-Hodgkin lymphoma that address MCL biology and treatment options, mantle cell lymphoma-specific fact sheets for both the frontline and refractory settings, as well as on supportive care, informational disease-specific e-newsletters, webcasts, podcasts, and videos, and a dedicated MCL website, and the URL is focusonmcl.org, which offers disease and treatment information as well as inspiring stories from MCL survivors. And we also offer our award-winning mobile app called Focus on Lymphoma. And this app provides patients and caregivers with comprehensive biology and treatment information on their lymphoma subtype, as well as tools to help manage your diagnosis and treatment side effects. The Focus on Lymphoma mobile app allows users to record doctor sessions, manage medications, track your blood work, and document treatment side effects. And it's available for free download on the Apple App Store and in Google Play. So I encourage you to download the app today. I hope that you take advantage of some of these great resources and services. And I also want to invite you to join us on January 23rd, 2018, from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time for an important teleconference that's going to review the scientific and research developments from the American Society of Hematology meeting. So for more information on LRF's mantle cell lymphoma programs, services, and resources, or to register for our upcoming review of ASH teleconference, please call our helpline toll-free at 800-500-9976, or you can visit us at lymphoma.org. Thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much, Max. That was wonderful. And also, for any of you who have not taken advantage of these wonderful services, please do contact Lymphoma Research Foundation. They're a wonderful resource. I'd like to say a few words about cancer care. Again, we've been working very closely with the Lymphoma Research Foundation now for many years. So cancer care provides actually a host of services to people, free services to people living with cancer and with lymphoma. So we offer financial assistance and co-payment assistance. We also have a range of counseling services provided by our oncology social workers, and those include the opportunity just to talk with someone about your concerns and questions. We also offer support groups on the telephone online, and the online groups are very popular to people both in the U.S. and internationally to participate in an online group with other people. And they don't occur in real time, so that you can post any time of the day, and you'll definitely have someone responding to you throughout that experience. We also have our publications and, of course, these workshops. So I would encourage you to take advantage of those services, and we will, of course, be including all the contact information for both organizations for you to have, so you can call us, email us, visit our websites, all of that. So now we want to take questions, and I know we're eager to get questions asked of our speakers. We already have some questions in the queue already, but I'm going to ask Crystal if she would go ahead and explain to everybody how to queue for questions, and if you would please put all of our speakers on board right now so they can all be there to answer any questions that come up. And Crystal?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Rosemary M. Your line is open.
Yes, good afternoon. I was listening, and Dr. Call had talked about the initial treatment strategy around the world as it relates to different factors in regards to older patients and younger patients. And I wanted to know whether or not he can elaborate on the different factors relating to younger patients, the less intensive approaches.
Well, thank you, Rosemary, for that question. And Dr. Kao, could you address this question in a general way? And then, Rosemary, we'll definitely encourage you to go back to your treating healthcare team. But Dr. Kao, if you could start with that question.
Well, I'll admit I'm not 100% sure I understand the question. What I heard was focused on specific factors related to younger patients, and maybe the caller is interested on what sort of parameters we look at and try and decide what's, you know, the optimal approach for a younger patient with all the different options. So I'll take a stab at that, and hopefully I'm in the ballpark there. So if you have a younger patient with a new diagnosis of mantle cell lymphoma, and most of the studies will limit the intensive approach up until about age 65. Some will go up to age 70, almost never go above that. And to be honest, everybody on the call, we've just learned the hard way over the years that when you try to take older patients through such aggressive, harsh therapies, it's usually not worth it. It's the toxicity is too much. The results are not as good. It's not the right trade-off between the toxicity and the efficacy of the treatment. So that's why those lines kind of get drawn where they do. Now, younger patients tend to handle the intensive treatments better. Their bodies recover faster. And so that's why that's a viable option for a younger patient with mantle cell lymphoma. But they don't have to do an intensive strategy. Certainly, younger patients can opt for non-intensive approaches. The trade-off there is the non-intensive strategies. Generally, the remissions aren't as durable with a non-intensive strategy as they are with an intensive strategy. However, getting through the treatment is easier, and so there's a trade-off there. And so really, I think it's up to the physician, treating physician, to have this discussion with their patient and go through these trade-offs. And different patients will come to different conclusions, even with the same information. And so it's a very personal decision. There's not a right or a wrong here. And you really just have to have a thoughtful conversation with the patients. If the disease seems more aggressive biologically, if they have an unfavorable MIPI score or the Ki-67 shows higher proliferation, I think most of us would be less enthused about the non-intensive strategies if you have a young patient. We might try to steer the patient toward a more aggressive strategy if the disease seemed to have some more aggressive features. That's a general statement, maybe not 100% true, but those are some of the criteria that go into our decision-making.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. And a question now for Dr. Gopal. Dr. Gopal, from one of our online participants, what are the most promising clinical trials for relapsed MCL? And if you could answer this in a general way as well, because some of those are, sort of to, even to talk about the concepts and what's available.
Right. So, yeah, so I think, you know, obviously this is a tough question. I think the exciting part is that there are lots of clinical trials available. As I mentioned, you know, I think there's a lot of excitement right now about this technology where we can modify the T cells and reinfuse them, the chimeric antigen receptor modified T cells. You know, there's a lot of excitement there. We will have to see the results. But I think some of probably the most useful trials are actually the ones that are these comparative trials, randomized phase 3 trials, and those are the ones that really help guide our decision making. And they may not have the newest agent, but they often have large enough numbers and address more important questions in terms of actually telling us when we should make a choice of agent A over agent B. So, you know, I think promising is in the eye of the beholder. I think we all get excited about new technology and new strategies. I suspect the CAR T cells will find their place in the treatment of lymphoma, and certainly we are hopeful that that their place will include mantle cell lymphoma, but we really don't know until these trials are done. So I think it would be inappropriate for me to point you at one particular drug or any particular study, but we all do get excited about new technologies that appear to be effective for mantle cell lymphoma.
Thank you. And a question for Dr. Kahl, and it's really, there are two parts to it, so I'm going to, but there were, I think, similar questions. I'm just diagnosed, and is watch and wait the best option ever? And the second part is, so please address indolent mantle cell lymphoma, how to handle, how to treat when it becomes active, how to handle the anxiety associated with waiting for the cancer to become active. So if you could address those questions.
Sure. Yeah. So it's always a tricky issue trying to recommend this watch and wait strategy to a newly diagnosed cancer patient. The whole strategy is so counterintuitive, and so very hard for individuals to accept that. It really comes down to our belief that mantle cell lymphoma right now is largely incurable. If we could cure it reliably, then we wouldn't watch and wait anybody. You know, we would treat and we would go for cure and we would try to eradicate it and be done with it once and for all. But because it's a disease that tends to come back, you have to think about mantle cell like a chronic illness, and you have to think about it as an illness that you have to manage over a long period of time. How do you manage it? How do you control it? And so taking patients through periods of observation without treatment is just part of a long-term management strategy. If the disease is low volume and the patient has no symptoms, it's a perfectly appropriate strategy. The advantage for the patient is they get to live their life free of symptoms of the disease, because by definition they don't have symptoms right now, and they get to live their life free of side effects of treatment. That's the advantage. It also allows you to save your ammunition. You know, we have a lot of good treatments for mantle cell lymphoma, but the pile of ammunition is not infinite and you can run out. And so you really want to use your treatment options judiciously. You don't want to burn through all of your ammo in the first 5 years. And so the idea of watching fits in this notion of managing a disease over a long period of time. Having said that, I recognize there are some patients who psychologically struggle tremendously with the notion that I have this cancer and we're not doing anything about it. And most of the time I can get people comfortable with this strategy, most of the time, but I will admit that is not always the case. And the reason to do the watch and wait is there's a quality of life advantage for the patient, but there's only a quality of life advantage if the patient becomes comfortable with it. If the patient is miserable because of the anxiety, then there is no quality of life benefit anymore. And I have taken patients and moved them on to treatment because they were so unhappy with the watch and wait strategy. We had sort of lost the proposed quality of life advantage because of the psychological issues. So, you really have to get to know your patient and talk this through and think it through and then work out your strategy together.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Excellent. And a question for Dr. Gopal. So what is the usual indicator of relapsed mantle cell? Is it in the blood work or tumors, or how is it discovered, Dr. Gopal?
Okay. Well, you know, I don't know if there's a usual, but it's similar to other lymphomas. It somewhat depends on how the mantle cell lymphoma presented itself in the first place. if the new diagnosis of mantle cell lymphoma was discovered based on abnormal cells in the blood, which is some mantle cell lymphoma patients have abnormal the mantle cell lymphoma cells in the blood, it might be detectable just based on a routine laboratory test. If the more common situation, there are enlarged lymph nodes, there could be enlarged lymph nodes that one could feel on physical examination, or one could detect with a CT scan or a PET scan. Sometimes it gets detected by doing other procedures like endoscopy and looking in the gastrointestinal tract or looking at the bone marrow. And, you know, and one question that comes up is how often should one look and how should one look? And I think this really gets back to a discussion with your physician about how risky is the mantle cell and how much might it be bothering you? Because even if there's a small change on a CT scan or a small lymph node that one can feel, it does not necessarily mean that one has to immediately start therapy for relapse disease. But the relapse is usually detected in a similar way to how it initially presented.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we have another question from one of our online participants for Dr. Kahl. How long does it take to see some results that Revlimid is working? Shrinkage of enlarged spleen.
Was it Revlimid, did I hear?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Revlimid is the trade name for a drug called lenalidomide that I had mentioned, which is an FDA-approved agent for recurrent lymphoma and has been being studied as part of initial therapy. Typically, the responses are pretty prompt. Lenalidomide is a drug that seems to work through the immune system. So occasionally we see these so-called flare reactions where the lenalidomide therapy will kind of trigger the patient's immune system to go and start fighting the cancer. And as the immune cells rush into the lymph nodes to start fighting the lymphoma, the lymph nodes actually get bigger initially. And this can actually can actually almost fake you out into thinking the disease is getting worse, but it's actually not. That's called pseudoprogression. And if you're just patient and keep going with therapy, the lymph nodes will eventually start to regress. So that's the one thing you have to be careful of with lenalidomide is the so-called pseudoprogression, which happens usually in the first couple of weeks on therapy. When lenalidomide is effective, I think you will see improvement in the amount of disease by the 8-week mark on treatment.
Excellent, thank you. And we have a question from one of our telephone participants. Crystal?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jonathan L. Your line is open.
I have a question. I was a donor. And what is the age, why is there an age limit on being an allogeneic donor?
That's a good question. Thank you. I'm going to ask both Dr. Kahl. Dr. Kahl, do you want to address that to begin with? And Dr. Gopal, you wish to add to it? Thank you for the question.
Well, the donor is donating stem cells and hematopoietic stem cells. And you know, every cell type in our body really has an age limit on it. And so, in general, we want to give the recipient of these hematopoietic stem cells the youngest possible donor cells we can find. And so, in general, younger cells are more desirable than older cells, or cells from younger donors are more desirable than cells from older donors. I think different institutions have different age cutoffs. I would be curious to hear Dr. Gopal's view on this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would concur with that. I I do. There is probably quite a bit of variability in terms of donor center and age cutoff, and it also, to some degree, depends on who the what the other donor options may be related to a matched donor that might be older versus a mismatched donor that might be younger. A lot of these things are based on a variety of factors. There's also some not significant but not zero risk to donating, and certainly if for undergoing the apheresis procedure, if it's a peripheral blood stem cell donation and undergoing or undergoing general anesthesia and a bone marrow harvest, that does carry some risk, and sometimes the judgment is made based on that. And then finally, there's some somewhat controversial data about the impact of just age alone, donor age alone, on graft versus host disease. So these factors come into play, and there is significant institutional variability.
Thank you. And a question for Dr. Gopal. So my dad, patient, is 56 years old, not qualified for SCT, and treated first line with R-CHOP and 2 years of R-maintenance. If and when the MCL comes back, what would you recommend to keep in mind to speak to the doctor about for the best current relapse approach? Also, we did not feel comfortable stopping the R-maintenance after 2 years, but were told that that was the maximum dose. Could he be treated again with Rituxan if there is any relapse? So a lot of questions here. If you could answer this in a general way, Dr. Gopal, that would be helpful to our callers so that they could, and to everybody, actually, because
right.
I'm sure many people wonder about these questions. Thank you.
Right. So, yeah, so I think it's, you know, as you said, Dr. Messner, these questions are hard to answer in a specific way, but in terms of general approach, some of the factors that I consider when choosing what the next regimen would be, first is how symptomatic is the patient? Is this a relapse that is detected just based on a very sensitive blood test or very small but slightly larger lymph nodes? And there can be a period of observation that can go on for some period of time, even in the relapse setting. As Dr. Call had mentioned, we have to think about the long game with mantle cell lymphoma. It's not something that we definitely know that being very aggressive and spending all your ammo, as was referenced, is the right thing to do at any given time point. So we look at how long it has been since the last therapy. How is this relapse presenting? Is it very minimal, or is somebody having lots of symptoms? And we use that kind of information, as well as any other medical problems a patient may have, and their preferences in terms of choosing what the next therapy might be. I would always encourage people to inquire about clinical trial options if they're appropriate. So I would encourage that question to be asked to a healthcare provider. But I think the tough part of this, of course, is that we now have lots of options. But that's also great, because this is when we're playing this long game, it allows us to use all these different types of ammo that we might have to try to keep this at bay as long as possible. So that's my general strategy. There was a specific question about whether rituximab could be used again. The answer in general is yes. If somebody has lymphoma that's getting worse while receiving rituximab, I'm less enthusiastic about using it in most situations. But if someone has been off rituximab for a while and there is a recurrence, rituximab can still be effective. So hopefully that's a helpful overall strategy.
Thank you. That's excellent. Thank you very much. And next question for Dr. Call is, what causes an indolent, non-symptomatic type of MCL to later come alive, develop symptoms, and become aggressive, even if one had the TP53 deletion at diagnosis?
Well, that's a really good question. Mantle cell, like any cancer, can change its behavior over time. The cancer cells are genetically unstable, and by that I mean the quality control mechanisms inside those cells are defective, and that makes the DNA prone to additional mutations. The cells had to mutate in the first place to become cancer cells, so that's kind of a sign that the quality control is bad already, and that just makes the cells more susceptible for additional mutations. And we know these mutations happen over time. Fortunately, most of these mutations end up being silent or no big deal, but occasionally a mutation will pop into the cancer cell population that makes the cancer more aggressive. So you almost have to think of the cancer as a population of cells, and within the population you get mutant populations that outgrow from the main population as these mutations occur. And so it's almost a random event. And when we have a mantle cell patient whose disease has been behaving itself very nicely for a long time and suddenly it turns very aggressive, we assume that the cells have mutated additionally, and one of these mutations just made the cells start to grow in a much more aggressive fashion. And that's a statement that's probably true of just about any cancer that behaves one way for a period of time and is now behaving a different way.
Thank you. And this question is for, I think, for Dr. Kyle and Dr. Gopal. How does a Canadian with MCL access clinical trials in the United States? Is that due, or Max, does anyone have a sense of that? That works?
I'm happy to give my thoughts.
We're pretty close
to Canada up here in Seattle.
Excellent. Thank you.
We do have a number of patients from Canada who call about clinical trials, and I think it is challenging. I don't have an easy answer. I think most clinical trials will provide the actual study drug if there is a investigational drug or specific research related tests, but they do not cover the standard clinical care, which is often very costly. And there are patients from Canada who can afford to pay without insurance, and some have special insurance policies that they've purchased independently that will cover their care outside of Canada. But it is quite challenging to participate in clinical trials without U.S. some kind of insurance within the United States.
Okay. Excellent. So we would recommend, Ben, that you do explore this with, I guess, the center that you're considering, and there may be staff there that could help with that. That would be often a good thing to do. And certainly call the Lymphoma Research Foundation line as well as the Cancer Care line for any help that we can all provide as well. But certainly the institutions themselves, they probably have staff to help with this as well. It sounds like it may be fairly common. It may be a more common experience, and there may be some other help that you can receive for this. Max, if you want to comment on this, that there are some also trials going on in Canada as well. Is that so? That there's, of course, a great deal that you can access from that. Indeed, on our program that we're doing in January, an update on lymphoma from the ASH meeting, one of the speakers is from Canada, so that indeed that's another option, just to be aware of the trials going on in Canada itself.
I would also encourage any patients on the call who reside in Canada to work with one of our partners, Lymphoma Canada. They're a great patient advocacy organization as well for lymphoma patients, and their website is www.lymphoma.ca.
Excellent.
And I was just going to say there's some fantastic cancer centers in Canada that have many of the world leaders in lymphoma research that are located within Canada. So you have some fantastic opportunities there.
You probably have the reverse question of people who want to access. So I think it's really important to kind of take advantage. That's a wonderful resource to have, and to work with the Lymphoma Canada. That sounds like a wonderful group, and so please do take advantage of that as well. And we have one late-breaking question, actually, for Dr. Gopal. Do you know approximately how many patients are participating in the T-cell trials for MCL, and how long until the results will be?
I don't know the answer to that question. Yeah, that's a question we all want to know. I think the published results are really from many of the phase one type trials, and they're really just being just the first studies to see how safe these agents were. And they're very small numbers, you know, just handfuls of patients at this point, really just anecdotes. There are large studies that are ongoing, but I am not... I don't know when we're going to see those results, so I think we're just going to have to wait a little bit. But there are studies available at a variety of centers across the country, and I think if that's something that someone is interested in, they should probably speak with someone at one of these centers to see what studies may be available.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've been really exceptional. This is an amazing call. We definitely, I should let you all know that if you wanted to listen to this call again, it will be available on our websites as a podcast or on telephone replay. Give it within 24 hours, or sometimes it takes, within 24 hours it should be up. Also, in addition to that, I do want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning this program, we know that you have many, many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And if we didn't get to all of your questions, and I know there are many more questions in queue, I just want to give you some ideas of how to get your questions answered. So, of course, you all have your healthcare team, which is, of course, an important resource to everyone on this call. But I know that many of you would like to actually get information from other sources as well. So I do... because we're doing this call, of course, with Lymphoma Research Foundation, and they have a wonderful line, and you can call them at 1-800-500-9976 with some medical questions that you may have. We also give people the phone number for the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237, and they do have a website, www.cancer.gov, and they have a live chat feature, so for people internationally, and the same is true for Lymphoma Research Foundation. They also have a website that you can access as well, and you can ask your questions and get help in that way as well for lymphoma-specific questions. And for those of you who would like to participate in upcoming conferences that Lymphoma Research Foundation is offering or other publications that they may have, please do call them. And for cancer care, if you would like to access our services with one of our social workers or access financial assistance, then just go ahead and call our phone numbers. Most importantly, as we conclude today's call, we don't want any one of you to feel that you're alone in coping with lymphoma. We do want you to feel that you're part of this bigger community of help, and they were all here to help you. And I think as Max has said, we do have a program coming up on January 23rd. It's a Tuesday. Update on lymphoma from the 2017 ASH annual meeting, and that's from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern time. And I know many of you have signed up for already, but if you haven't, please do. And we do have a program tomorrow, because this did come up during the call today, Mind-Body Techniques to Cope with the Stresses of Cancer. And that's actually tomorrow, November 15th, from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern time. And you can simply register for that on the Cancer Care website. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. You asked great questions. This is a phenomenal audience. And I want to hope you all go back to your healthcare team, utilize the information that you received today, and also call us, call Lymphoma Research Foundation, for any further help that you may need. Thank you, and have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.